Okay, I think we should resume. Presumably a few more people will come back in. We left off, I was attempting to develop the point, to develop the scope of the need for wealth, to show that it's necessary to virtually every human activity. It facilitates it in some way. And I just gave the illustration of the wealth adapted to music. Now, the wealth adapted to art includes all of the books of art, reprints of paintings, museums, schools where art is taught. It hopefully will include, in years to come, these wall-mounted LCD monitors or plasma monitors. One of the things Microsoft is engaged in is buying up the rights to famous paintings around the world. That'll be something that'll be shown someday on these devices. Science, all of the laboratory apparatus, the university buildings, the textbooks of science, this represents wealth adapted to science. Take it away, and science would be reduced to a meager oral tradition, people scratching a circle in the sand with their toe, perhaps. We could not have anything remotely approaching the science that we have without very considerable wealth employed in its accumulation and dissemination. And I should have mentioned computers. That's certainly very important, too, in science. Athletics, the athletic equipment, the athletic stadiums, the television cameras, the television sets that enable people to watch these events. Human relationships. Just think how wealth in such forms as telephones, pens, paper, post offices, automobiles, airplanes, trains, make it possible to maintain human relationships over time and distance. If we didn't have these things, when a child moved any considerable distance from his parents and his childhood friends, that would be the end of those relationships. They would then exist just as memories. I wonder if any of you can think of an example of a human activity that is not improved in some way by the employment of wealth. Can you think of anything where that is just not true, that wealth makes no difference to the activity? What would be an example of such a thing?
Philosophy class.
Philosophy class. Well, what about the classroom? What about the books? How much philosophy could we have if we did not have the various philosophy books? Take away Aristotle, that's a big diminution in philosophy. Take away Plato, you have a further diminution. Take away the books of all of the significant philosophers, and how much is left of philosophy? Not much. Yes, Mr.
What about meditation?
Meditation. Okay, well, maybe that would be a candidate. If your goal is simply to make your mind a blank, but I imagine you could do that in more comfortable or less comfortable surroundings. But that is probably the closest that I've ever heard anyone come to an example of something that is not facilitated in any significant way by wealth. Any other contenders? Sometimes people say sex. I don't think that would be a good example. Think of such things as inner spring mattresses. running water, perfume, lingerie. So there's a lot of things. Now, I refer to the psychological aesthetic aspects of the satisfaction of physical needs. We have certain needs that can be described as physical, our need for nutrition, our need for elimination. But our nature as rational beings and the psychology that that entails introduces additional aspects in the satisfaction of our needs. When we eat, the food is not the sole consideration. There are related issues, such as the ambience, the atmosphere. We're interested in things like the china on which the food is served, the table setting. Is there music in the background? Are you seated in a plush, comfortable chair? And other things of this kind. When we eliminate, we gain something important, I think, from things like indoor plumbing and proper ventilation. These are necessary for what you can call psychological aesthetic reasons. As rational beings, I think we also have a need for variety and novelty. A cow is content to eat the same kind of grass day in and day out. But human beings have a need for changes in their routine, breaks in the same pattern, which they find intellectually refreshing. And I think most of us find the appearance of new gadgets something very interesting and enjoyable. And when we buy major goods, newer models as replacements, that's something that's typically an enjoyable experience, buying a new car, something of this kind. And the fact that we derive intellectual refreshment from novelty and variety and are willing to do things for the sake of their novelty, this has important ultimate practical benefits. See, would we even have something like the automobile if the first adopters had not been free to adopt it just because of the sheer joy of that novelty? Here we are back 110 years ago, let's say. The very first automobiles appear, and they're astonishing machines. The horseless carriage, for all of history up to that point, the best form of locomotion that we could have of a personal nature was a horse or a horse-drawn carriage. And now here's this machine that doesn't need a horse. Well, was the automobile a practical means of transportation right away? No, it took a while, but the fact that there were people willing to buy them just for the sheer joy of the new and novel, that gave the automobile industry a start. And then they, from there, they improved the quality of the product, cut the cost, and the basis was laid for a major industry. More recently, perhaps in the experience, the personal experience of some of you, if you're in your 40s or 50s, the personal computer industry. When that started in the very late 70s, that was pretty much a kind of intellectual toy. And because it got a toehold on that basis, it became possible later on to extend the product and develop really practical applications. The point here is the fact that we desire wealth in novel forms leads us to experiment in ways we otherwise wouldn't, and to find practical applications that otherwise would not have any chance of coming up. We can't always insist that we know the practical applications from the very beginning. It's important to be able to experiment with new forms of wealth just for their sheer novelty and intellectual challenge. Now, I make a further point related, point two, the perfectibility of human need satisfactions and the use of human faculties. Now, there we pretty much have the same basic needs throughout man's entire presence on Earth. People have always had a need for nutrition, and they've had a need for health. They've had a need to be able to move. We have the faculties of seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and the ability to think. And the use of wealth improves our ability to exercise all of our faculties and capacities. Let's take start off with the wealth applicable to the needs for nutrition and health. Now, our caveman ancestors produced food, and it kept enough of them alive to feed offspring to at least maintain their population, and then slowly and gradually to increase it. So they were satisfying their need for nutrition and health to some extent. But what was the extent of the wealth they used to do so? Well, their labor, that isn't the wealth, but that's the means of producing it. What wealth did they produce to satisfy their need for nutrition?
Arrowheads,
flint objects. Flint objects, arrowheads, spears, maybe slingshots, some primitive traps, nets perhaps to catch some fish. So this is some wealth employed in satisfying the need for nutrition. What's the extent of the wealth we employ today, directly or indirectly, in satisfying our need for nutrition?
Slaughterhouses,
the distribution channels, what do you mean, the trucks and so on. And what else?
Canneries,
fishing boats, canneries, not just for fish, what?
Farming.
Okay. Chemical fertilizer. What stands behind the farming? A chemical fertilizer is one. What else? Well, genetic engineering is only now beginning to come.
The
packaging. And what enables the farmers to farm with the success they do? What would be some examples of things that radically improve agricultural productivity?
Combines.
What?
Combines.
Tractors, harvesters. And what do these things depend on?
Steel,
the iron to produce the steel.
Petroleum.
Petroleum to make the fuel, the factories to construct these things. Electric power to enable the equipment in the factories to work, ships and trains and cargo planes to move these things around, the mines where the ores come from. If you think about it, a huge chunk of the economic system is directly or indirectly connected with our satisfaction of our need for nutrition. Now, why do it in such an elaborate wealth-using way? Why not be content to have a simple wooden plow, some hunting implements?
For scale.
Pardon me? Well, what do we accomplish with the means that we use?
More efficient
production. A vastly greater production, requiring much less overall labor, sparing labor for the production of many, many other things, and giving us a much wider range of food and a much better diet, which has a major contribution to our health and life expectancy. And the wealth that's applicable to our need for health, well, that certainly includes the pharmaceutical industry, the chemical industry that supplies it, the hospital buildings, the construction industry that builds them, all of the diagnostic equipment, the prosthetic devices, and indirectly our food supply. That's a major preventive of very many illnesses we might otherwise contract. Now, going even further, I want to indicate how different forms of wealth that we have facilitate what we're able to accomplish with our senses, our eyes, our ears, and our brains, and also our limbs. What would be forms of wealth that enable us to take in more information and experience through our eyes? What would be some illustrations? Pardon me?
Television.
Eyeglasses.
Television.
Contacts. Pardon me?
Computers.
Well, the computer monitor, you could say. Now, more recently, lasers to correct various eye problems like cataracts, glaucoma. Lasers are being used, and I guess in other applications. Motion pictures, someone said television sets, DVDs, VCRs. These are things that are enabling us to take in more information and experience through our eyes. Motion pictures, I think I said that. What about our ears?
Hearing aids.
Our hearing aids.
Stereos,
hi-fis, phonographs, CDs, iPods now. I forgot to mention microscopes and telescopes in connection with our eyes. What about our ability to move about? What would be various forms of wealth that contribute to our capacity for locomotion?
Segways?
Well, segways, that's one little device. That's that, what is that, sort of gyroscopic bicycle or something? Okay, what would be more significant, although that's legitimate? Pardon me?
Automobiles.
Yeah, automobiles. Starting, going way back, starting with shoes, rafts, canoes, sailing vessels, pardon me?
Horses.
Any other domesticated animal, camels, elephants, wagons and the wheel, oxen, then railroad trains, then automobiles, airplanes, rocket ships. They're all in the category of things that contribute to our ability to move about. Now, their connection seems to be primarily through to magnifying the power of our legs. But think about the fact that any machine or tool is enabling us to accomplish more with one or other of our limbs. Think of a tool like a hammer or a screwdriver. We're using them with our hands. Could we accomplish with our bare hands what we typically need a hammer for? I don't think so. Could we shape an automobile fender without fairly complicated equipment? I don't think we could do that. All tools and implements enable us to accomplish more with the same four limbs. And these other things enable us to accomplish more with the same eyes, ears. And then there are things that enable us to accomplish more with our same brains, such as books, calculators, and now, more recently, computers. So we need wealth, really. If we value such things as seeing, hearing, moving, and doing, wealth contributes to all of this. It's in the name of all of these things and the various other activities, art, science, music, personal relationships, athletics. In the name of all of these things, we implicitly must value wealth. If we value being able to do these things, we need to value wealth. And we need to value what wealth itself depends on, a division of labor, society, and capitalism. Now, I have a brief discussion here in point three. It's considerably longer in the text, of the fundamental bases of our limitless need and desire for wealth. I say the capacity of our imaginations exceeds the power of our arms. Our desire for wealth surpasses our ability to produce it, because what do you need to form a desire for wealth?
Knowledge of it.
Knowledge of it. Imagine it. What do you need to desire a mansion? Think of it. Visualize the mansion. What would you need to either build the mansion or produce goods sufficient to be able to earn the money to buy the mansion? Which do you think is more difficult?
To get the goods to buy.
Obviously, to produce the goods. Because when we produce, What does our ability to produce always reduce to ultimately? Well, even if you're a top executive, what limits what you're able to accomplish, even as president of General Motors?
Source of labor.
Well, you personally, what limits what you personally can accomplish?
Your imagination.
Well,
or your visualization.
You have to put anything you're imagining to translate into practice. What stands between the imagination and getting a practical plan of action? You need a lot of work, right? Now, you only have a limited number of hours in the day, and even if you're working at the highest level and you have a whole staff of secretaries and assistants and so on, still it will come down to what you are able to do. What memos can you dictate? What meetings can you conduct? What instructions can you give? What plans can you first have formulated? And that is always much, much more limited than your ability to imagine grandiose results. I can imagine hopping from Mars to Jupiter, but it'll be quite a different story if we're ever to accomplish such a result. And the way I put it here is our desire for wealth always surpasses our ability to produce it to the extent that our power of imagination exceeds the power of our arms, taking our arms as our physical means of accomplishing results. You could add to that our power to dictate memos, holding the voice recorder or whatever. Our ability to achieve results in the physical world is always on a vastly smaller scale than our ability to imagine the outcomes. Now, further, I try to go into this at an even deeper level. I say that our possession of reason gives us the potential for a limitless range of knowledge and awareness. And this, I think, is the ultimate foundation of our having a limitless need and desire for wealth. So you just think, all other animals besides human beings can only have knowledge of what they can perceive, what they can see, hear, taste, touch, or smell. If you have a pet cat or dog, what's the range of awareness of your pet? In order for your pet to be aware of a rabbit, he has to be able to see the rabbit, hear it, or smell it. If the rabbit is out of the range of his field of senses, he has no awareness of the rabbit. And all animals are limited to their range of sensory awareness. But human beings have something that goes beyond the five senses. They have their brains that are capable of forming concepts and thinking logically. See, we can be aware of something like a rabbit when there are no rabbits around. How are we aware of a rabbit when there's no rabbits around? We have the concept rabbit. We have the word rabbit. And that stands for the physical creature rabbit, all the different rabbits. And so we're in a position to have rabbits in our minds and to take action with respect to rabbits, even when none are around. And the nature of our conscious mind, of our rationality, is such that we are able to have knowledge ranging literally from subatomic particles to the entire universe and encompassing all kinds of things in between. We can be aware of all kinds of patterns, similarities, differences that lesser species have no awareness of. So this is the basis for a limitless range of knowledge and awareness. And it's on the basis of an organism's range of knowledge and awareness that its range of action and experience is based. See, what range of action can your dog take with respect to a rabbit?
It can watch it or can run after it.
Okay, if it sees it, it can do something. It could watch it or chase it. But if there's no rabbit around, if the dog can't be aware of the rabbit in its senses, is it able to take action with respect to the rabbit? Could your dog possibly say, you know, these rabbits keep coming back on the lawn, and they're not here right now, but I know they'll be back, so I'm going to do something to greet them when they come back next time. Like, I'll dig a hole that they'll fall in. That's unthinkable for a dog. But human beings are capable of such things, and human beings routinely take action with respect to things thousands of miles away and years in the future. I would be surprised if the company you work for did not have contractual relationships with companies either on the East Coast of the United States or over in Japan or China, and did not have contracts extending 5, 10, maybe 20, or even 50 years in the future. Well, these things are possible because our form of consciousness gives us the ability to have knowledge of these things and awareness. So our range of knowledge and awareness underlies our range of action. We can act with respect to thousands of miles away. We can fire a rocket outside the solar system. And our range of experience, too. The fact that we have the kinds of brains that we do enable us to listen to a piece of music and hear it very, very differently than our pet cat or dog hears it. You can listen to a symphony with your pet dog or cat, and it does not hear it the way you do. It doesn't hear the harmonies or melodies, and probably not the rhythm. You can look at a painting or a drawing, and you can see what it represents. Show the same thing to your pet, and it's clueless. So we are able to have experience of things like paintings, sculptures. We can perceive beauty in things. We can experience beautiful landscape grounds, works of fine art. Our pets cannot. We're able to employ all kinds of tools and implements and so forth because we possess reason the animals can't. Now, the fact that we have a limitless range of knowledge and awareness underlying a limitless potential for action and experience, all we need to do is add one further step, and that is that wealth is the material means of acting and experiencing. Wealth in the form of all kinds of tools, implements, this represents instrumentalities, means by which we act upon the world. And then there's wealth in the form of objects of contemplation, which make it possible for us to have experiences. We can also enjoy experiences in using means of action. Like a bobsled or a snowmobile is a means of action, and it could also be an enjoyable experience. Wealth is a means to have actions and enjoyable experiences, both through various types of actions and through objects of contemplation. And there being no limit to our potential for action and experience, there's no limit to our need for wealth. We need wealth to be able to accomplish anything we might want to accomplish. Okay, now, at the very outset of tonight, someone asked the question that pertained to diminishing returns and the division of labor. Let me just give a little elaboration on that under the heading of the naturalness and necessity of economic progress. There's a sense in which economic progress is natural, but in quotes. That means it's not guaranteed. It's not automatic. It may happen. There's a reasonable basis for it happening, but it isn't automatic or guaranteed. And what would make economic progress natural and overcome problems of diminishing returns is what I refer to as the result of the use of reason as a constant. The use of reason as a constant just means that people are continuing to think, or large numbers of them are. Now, just imagine a society that has this as a dominant characteristic, the use of reason. An accompaniment of this, which needs to be explicitly named, would be a functioning educational system. Now just consider, what is the basic purpose of education? What is it supposed to accomplish if and when it's working?
The improvement of individuals of a country so they can in turn be productive members of society.
Well, that's true, but there's a specific means, and that is to impart to the rising generation all of the significant knowledge accumulated by all of the previous generations. What education is supposed to do, I believe, is to pass on to the rising generation the sum of all of the significant knowledge of all of the previous generations. Now, what happens if the educational system is succeeding in doing that, by and large, and the rising generation can be characterized to a significant degree as itself continuing to use reason, continuing to think? What will be the outcome as far as the stock of knowledge goes? It should increase, because the new generation will start out with all of the previous knowledge and make its own fresh contribution, which will then be incorporated into the education of the next generation. So that next generation will start out with a better stock of knowledge than its parents. And what will happen if that new generation continues to think? Okay, then you have a further improvement in the stock of knowledge. So it's in this way that the stock of knowledge will tend to be progressive. It will be the result of the use of reason as a constant, incorporating under the use of reason a functioning educational system. So that's the basis, a fundamental basis for expecting the possibility of continuous economic progress. The fact that each generation is able to have a larger stock of knowledge than the generation before it. And that, of course, would include science and technology. And very closely related is a similar process with capital equipment. If we start out, if we improve the state of capital equipment, which we should expect to do if we have an improving state of technological and scientific knowledge, well, that should mean we should have some better capital equipment. And what should you be able to do with better capital equipment compared to the previous poorer capital equipment in terms of the results you can physically accomplish? You should be able to produce more, including capital equipment. To illustrate this, there was a time when there were no railroads. And the very first railroads had to be constructed on a foundation that did not include railroads. So that was quite difficult. But what was the effect on the ability to construct railroads once we got the first few railroads? It made it easier. We could build some bigger, better railroads because now we had the contribution of previously constructed railroads. And this could be dynamic. And the same point would apply to steel mills. The first steel mills had to be built when there were no steel mills. But once we got steel mills, wouldn't that make a contribution to further steel mills? Bigger, better steel mills. A further analogy or further example, not all that long ago, there were no computers. The first computers had to be constructed without computers. But once you had some computers, what did that do to the ability to make computers? You could make bigger, better computers. And with bigger, better computers, how did that affect the ability to produce computers? The same way. So there's a kind of progressivity in the nature of improving capital equipment if it's joined by continual improvements in the state of science and technology. The better capital equipment will enable us to accomplish greater physical results, including the production of still better capital equipment. Now, none of this is automatic or guaranteed, but this process is necessary if we are to offset the operation of the law of diminishing returns. You see, the operation of diminishing returns can be offset through scientific and technological progress. If we didn't have continuing scientific and technological progress, what would be the effect of population growth? P- Pardon me?
It would suffocate the system.
It would suffocate the system by virtue of the operation of what principle that we've discussed? Diminishing returns, law of diminishing returns. But with scientific and technological progress, we can overcome that. We can more than overcome it. And what is the likelihood of having the scientific and technological progress if we have an absolutely larger population participating in the division of labor, and thus an absolutely larger number of people pursuing careers in science, technology, and business? Won't it be more likely? I would think so. Now, there's a further respect in which I refer to a necessity of economic progress. It's not really necessary. It's necessary if you want to be happy. You can think of it as that way. As rational beings, we're aware of the future. The future casts its shadow over the present. If you have the kind of mind that thinks of the future. Now, what kind of future will cast a better, happier shadow? If you can look forward to the future being better than the present, or the future being no better or worse? How does the prospect of a better future make us feel in the present? I think it makes us feel better because we have something good to look forward to. Our present circumstances might be pretty bad, but if we can look forward to years in the future when things will be better, well, then we know there's something that we can enjoy at some point. And that enables people to endure considerable hardship in the present. And I think perhaps that applies to you. You're working full-time jobs. You have family commitments, and on top of that, you're here 4 or 8 hours a week. But why are you doing it? Why you undergo this hardship? Well, you're looking forward to completing the program, getting a degree, and then you expect that your prospects will be better. Well, what if this program were lifelong? And you would never finish it. Well, it feels like it. Okay. Well, you'd be less happy. And if the program were going to be progressively lengthened, so in a few years there'd be a third night and then a fourth, well, that would make you pretty miserable. And if you hold that in mind, suppose you live in a society that is progressing. If it's improving economically from year to year, that means that most of its members are getting better off as time goes on. So how do you think that will color their general outlook on the future? I think it'll be positive. It'll make them happier than they otherwise would be. They'll be eager for the future to come. In contrast, suppose you lived in a society where nothing could be expected to improve. Whatever it is, and that's it indefinitely. Well, then you don't have that prospect of the better future. Suppose you live in a society where the prospect is for decline. Even if you are at a very, very high level at present, if you're looking forward to going to a lower level, that's got to make you less happy in the present. So from this psychological aspect, I would say economic progress is something desirable on this basis as well. Now, as quickly as I can, I want to turn to a major principle of economics, the law of diminishing marginal utility. This is something very important in its own right. But it's also necessary, after I've explained what it is, to reconcile it with all that I've been saying up to now about our limitless need and desire for wealth. We'll see that some people claim these two are contradictory, that the law of diminishing marginal utility implies that our need for wealth is diminishing. Well, I start off with a statement of the law. The utility, all of these terms are interchangeable. The utility, importance, or subjective value, three interchangeable terms, that is attached to a unit of a good. diminishes as the quantity of the good one consumes or possesses increases. That's the law of diminishing marginal utility. The utility, importance, personal value that we attach to an equal unit of a good diminishes as the quantity of the good we consume or possess increases. I give two examples, successive glasses of water and Volbavik's pioneer with the five sacks of grain. Each of these illustrates a different aspect of the principle. Imagine that you're out in your yard on a hot day weeding the yard or planting things. And you've been doing this for a while and you get very, very thirsty. And at some point you come into the house and you want to drink some water. All right, being very, very thirsty, that first glass of water is going to be very, very satisfying. You'll probably want a second glass of water. Possibly you'll experience it as practically as satisfying, maybe fully as satisfying as the first. But do you think you'll stand there all day and into the night drinking successive glasses of water? No. Now, at some point, probably by the end of the third glass, you will stop. Now, if you do stop after the third glass, we would have to ask, why do you stop after the third glass? Why don't you go on to a fourth glass?
You're satisfied.
And that fourth glass, you'd expect, would make you feel less well than you are after the third glass. And the third glass is almost certainly less satisfying than the second glass. Now, why should it be that as you drink successive glasses, at least at some point, the utility or satisfaction that you derive from the same size glass of the same kind of water diminishes? Well, if it's the case that water satisfies thirst, you start out, you have a thirst that's unsatisfied as yet by any glass of water. After you drink the first glass, the second glass comes up against a thirst that has been at least partly satisfied by the first glass. The third glass comes up against a thirst that's been satisfied by two glasses. So the need is being satisfied by the water, and as it's satisfied, the remaining need is experienced as less urgent. And ultimately, you don't want any more, because then you have too much water. So wherever it's a matter of physical ingestion, I think to the extent that the goods satisfy the needs or wants, successive units are perceived as less valuable because they're coming up against needs and wants that have already been satisfied to some degree by the previous units. Now, another example of diminishing marginal utility, this time applying to the supply that one possesses rather than has already consumed. This example was given by one of the main founders of marginal utility economics, Eugen Böhm-Bawerk. He, incidentally, was my mentor's mentor. He was also the finance minister of Austria-Hungary right before, or shortly before, World War I. Now, an illustration that he gave of marginal utility was, imagine you have a pioneer farmer. He's got to make it through the winter. He needs a supply of grain to make it through the winter. He requires one sack of grain of a definite size in order to physically survive the winter, in order to provide him with enough food to get through the winter. If he has a second such sack, not only can he survive, but he will do so in good health. He will have enough to eat so that his health will be fully maintained. If he were to have a third sack, not only could he maintain his health, but he could also eat to the point of full satisfaction. He would experience the pleasure of feeling well fed. With a fourth sack, he could use grain to make a supply of brandy. With a fifth sac, he could accomplish everything with the first four sacs, plus feed a pet parrot. Now, imagine, we want to consider, what is the importance of a sac of grain in different contexts of different total supplies. Imagine that our pioneer farmer has just one sack of grain.
Extremely important.
Okay, his life depends on it. Imagine that some animal is threatening his one and only sack of grain. What would he be willing to do to save it? He'd risk his life, because if he loses the sack, he's dead. So he'd be willing to risk his life to save it. Now, if he has two sacks and an animal is threatening one of the sacks, or anything is jeopardizing one of the sacks, that's still very, very important, but not quite as important as the first and only sack. Because less depends on it. The dependent wants are less important. His health, however important it is less important than his very life. A third sack would be experienced as still less important, because now his health isn't, not even his health is dependent on it, it's his satisfaction. Would he be willing to do as much to save the third sack as the second? I don't think so. And on down with a fourth and fifth. So notice, here you are, you have an illustration. The larger the supply, the lower is the importance, utility, subjective value of any one unit. The importance of a given unit depends on how many units one has. Why? Because if one loses any given unit, the loss in want satisfaction will be less the more abundant one's supply. Let's carry this a little bit further. Point B, why does this law apply? Well, I refer to the rational choice to satisfy our more urgent wants ahead of our less urgent wants. What's the utmost important want that a sack of grain can satisfy in this illustration? What's the utmost important? His survival. So if you have one sack of grain, you devote that to providing for your survival, right? Now, what's the utmost important use to which a second sack can be put, given that you already have one? Providing for your health. That's the most important use open to it. What's the most important use open to a fifth sack, given that you have four, and those four have been devoted to the four most important uses? Feeding the parrot is now the most important use for a sack of grain. For the fifth sack, you've devoted, you see, each sack is devoted to its most important use. What does that imply about the most important use remaining for the next sack? It's less important. The most important is taken off the table. Then the second sack goes to the next most important. That's taken off the table. The most important uses are being taken off the table. And so the most important use remaining is progressively less important.
So with that said, I just can't help but think about the concept of wealth redistribution.
Yeah.
If the amount of wealth that somebody has is less important to them because they have that much more of it,
yeah.
Why wouldn't you make the argument that you would redistribute the wealth to somebody who might value it more or depend on it more for their survival or...
Okay. That's a very, very good question. And many, many economists have come to just the conclusion that you're asking about. If it's true that there's diminishing marginal utility, then isn't it true that $100 or whatever to a millionaire is much less important than $100 to a poor person? And therefore, they conclude, wouldn't marginal utility overall be improved if we take away a relatively small marginal loss from this rich or high-income person and give it to a poor person who will satisfy needs of greater urgency? Now, I would say there's an element of truth in that and an element of fallaciousness. There's a mixing of contexts. See, if we look at one and the same given individual in two different circumstances, in one, he's poor. in another, he's richer. And we ask, well, what's the importance to this individual of $100 when he's poor compared to when he's rich? Well, it's greater when he's poor than when he's rich. But it's a very different story if we're mixing individuals, trying to cut across among different individuals. Now we need to ask, what is the importance of the marginal unit to you, your marginal unit, your marginal $100, that will enable you to have dinner at a nice restaurant, let's say, versus the importance to you of giving that $100 to some stranger on the other side of the country or the world. Which is of more importance to you, your dinner, your luxury dinner somewhere, or the rice ration for people you have no connection with? Now, some people might say it's their rice ration. Now, if that's really true, what course of behavior would you think would follow from that? If it were really more important to you to provide some stranger's rice ration than your own luxury dinner, what would you be doing with the money? You'd be donating it, you'd be providing their rice ration. Now, do you think that food in someone, that necessary food in someone else's stomach, unrelated to you, unconnected to you in any way, do you think that that is more important, honestly, than your dessert?
No. Just to show how
miraculous. Pardon me?
Well, I mean, it just goes to show how the psychological emotions overtake people.
I'm not quite sure I understand the appraisal at the end. The wacko could be interpreted to apply to the people who don't give the rice ration or to the people who are urging them to do it. I'm not clear on what you have in mind, but either way, it's okay. But you see, there is a big difference between food in your stomach, food in your spouse's stomach, food in your children's stomach, and food in the stomach of people you've never met and have no connection with. It may well be the case that a mother will perceive food in her children's stomach as more important than food in her own stomach. From her own point of view, she values the life and health of the child possibly above her own, and that can happen. But would that mean that she would value the life and health of someone else's child above the life and health of her own child? That does not follow. Does it mean that she will value the necessities of strangers above her own luxuries? That does not follow. Now, people can attach some importance to the needs of strangers. I've indicated we have aesthetic, psychological needs, and I think we're all, we go to movies and we watch television shows, and we have no personal connection with the characters in the shows, but if there's some innocent victim about to be murdered by some heinous butcher, we want the police to get there in time to stop the prospective killer, right? And we get personally very involved. Or we read exciting stories, and we're on the side of the helpless and the innocent against the perpetrator of evil. And so we spend money going, buying books and going to movies and so on. And I think very, very similarly, we would like to see people avoid disaster and catastrophe. We would like to see a world in which no children are hungry, in which everyone is reasonably well provided for. And we're willing to do something about it up to a point, but the point does not go very far. Like you might conceivably be willing to donate a few percent of your income to achieve such projects, but that runs into marginal utility. You see, you might value a world where there's no suffering of the innocent and everyone has a reasonable degree of prosperity, but that runs into diminishing marginal utility quite quickly too, and when it gets to the point where it starts to deprive you of things that you attach any significant value to, you won't do it. And I think it's reasonable that you don't. Now, I would say if you have a serious rational desire to overcome poverty and suffering around the world, what could rationally achieve that? Not just in the name of you'll have good emotions and people will like you, but what rationally would stand a chance of accomplishing that is the establishment of laissez-faire capitalism around the world. And what you might do to promote that would be to make contributions to the dissemination of sound economic principles, and sound political philosophy, then there'd be some reasonable way that people around the world could make a better provision for themselves. But the idea that we'll just take wealth from some and that will be the solution, well, first of all, even if you could get the wealth, it wouldn't do it. The United States has about 5% of the world's population. Suppose we were willing to live at the average level of the world. How much of a dent could we make in global poverty? Not very much. And the fact is, we don't want to sacrifice our well-being to do that. And if the government were to attempt to take it from us by force, what would be the effect? Well, we wouldn't produce nearly as much as we do produce. See, there's no way to have very much in the way of forcible redistribution. Redistribution is not a practical policy. What is a practical policy is providing economic freedom for people to improve themselves. That's the main thing that needs to be done.
Has there been any example of collectivism that did work?
I can't think of any. I mean, maybe on a very small scale, in a religious fraternity, perhaps. Maybe if you have 10 brothers of a monastic order, something like that, maybe at some level it might work for them. If you had a group, a relatively small group, all of the members who knew each other and respected one another, liked one another, maybe they'd be willing to share. But think of it this way. Anytime you form such a group, if you have 10 people and they have to share everything equally, if any one member of the group is in a position to double his earnings, how much does he improve himself? By 1/10, right? Now suppose you have a group of 100 million people and someone is able to double his contribution. How much does he improve himself? How much does he improve the partner he loves? How much can he improve the well-being of his own children? By 1/100 millionth. So there's no reason for anybody to do anything. By the same token, if he does nothing, how much does he diminish his own well-being and those and that of anyone close to him? By virtually nothing. So there's no reason for anyone to do anything except the least they can. And the only way to get anything done in those circumstances is by force. It's a formula for slavery. Now, all over the world, I mean, you can see something very different that's raised the United States and every other first world country or country aspiring to be first world. And I discussed that somewhat last week. And that's the rational pursuit of material self-interest under freedom, where you leave people free to go out and actually do what's better for them, with the only restriction being they can't use force or fraud against anyone else. Then they can do what improves them, and at the same time, to get the voluntary cooperation of others, they have to benefit the others with whom they deal. This is the real engine of progress, not sacrifice and redistribution. Sacrifice and redistribution is a formula for permanent impoverishment. The reason so much of the world is so poor and has been through all of history is because it's been the philosophy of sacrifice and redistribution that has always ruled. So people have just been prohibited from achieving their own good and the good of those with whom they deal. Now, I refer to a need to, yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So what do you think of the socialism system, such as China? You know, there's certain freedom nowadays, right?
Yeah.
Where the population pursues economic gains.
Yeah.
So the state still controls some of the, I guess, the basic provisions, et cetera, right?
Yeah, China still has a dictatorship. And the state controls the press. It owns many branches of production. But what explains the great progress that China has made is the parts of the economy that have been freed up to foreign investment and individual entrepreneurs. So China is a mixed case, but I think it's a dramatic demonstration of the tremendous improvement that follows from freeing up self-interest. That's the point I was trying to make. If they had stuck with the policies of Mao Zedong, they would not have improved.
Now, wouldn't you think that if that works, in that as a mixed model like you're describing, they seem to be better off than certain other free countries like Haiti.
Like what?
Haiti.
Like Haiti.
And some other, let's say, you know, more impoverished countries, right? So wouldn't you say that maybe a similar system would be more beneficial to those other nations?
All right, now you refer to Haiti as a freer country than China. I would have to question that, I mean, in some superficial ways maybe,
yeah.
But I would think the opportunities for profitable investment and action are vastly greater in China than in Haiti, even if we took a comparable size. Like, I don't know the land area and population of Haiti. It's some thousands of square miles, however many hundreds of thousands or millions of people. If you took a comparable district in China, in one of the coastal provinces, I think it would be much easier, freer of arbitrary government interference today in China than in Haiti. So I don't think Haiti is it. In order to do anything in these places like Haiti, can you count on the sanctity of contracts? Can you count on the government not stopping you? See, China passed a critical test some years ago. There was a McDonald's that opened somewhere in the heart of Beijing. And the old-fashioned Chinese method was the local government officials can get away with anything they like. And so the mayor of Beijing at one point decided he wanted to change the terms of McDonald's lease and make them move to a less desirable location so that he could give their more desirable location to some friend of his. And McDonald's fought this. And they won in the Chinese legal system. And the mayor of Beijing had to resign from his job. And I think this was a very, very important precedent. It showed that there was going to be some sanctity given to contractual arrangements. Had it gone the other way, I think there would have been a major diminution in foreign investment in China. But the Chinese government was intelligent enough to recognize the importance of a policy of respecting contracts, and so they got rid of the mayor of Beijing. I don't think that would have happened in Haiti. In Haiti, it would have been the other way. Now, there'll probably be serious problems for China, because they have rich and poor, and they have a more prevalent communist mentality than we do. And so who knows what this can result in at some point in the future. Okay, well, let me turn to the claim that diminishing marginal utility implies a diminishing importance of wealth and its pursuit as such. This was an argument raised some decades ago by a very popular writer on economic subjects named John Kenneth Galbraith. I think he's still alive, somewhere in his 90s. He was ambassador. He was an advisor to President Kennedy. He was made ambassador to India under Kennedy. He taught economics for many years at Harvard. Before that, in World War II, he ran the Price Control Office, the Office of Price Administration, OPA. Now, at some point in his career, Galbraith wrote a book called The Age of Affluence. And in it, he argued that in the past, when our society was much poorer, it was reasonable for people to be concerned with the acquisition of wealth back in the 19th century. and for the cultural heroes, accordingly, to be figures like businessmen. Businessmen were the leading figures in the production of wealth. Production of wealth was vitally important then because we had so little of it, and so businessmen could properly be the cultural heroes. But now we are affluent. We're much, much richer. And so the marginal utility of wealth is much, much lower. And Galbraith thought he was being original in arriving at the conclusion that diminishing marginal utility applies to wealth as such and not merely to this or that good, like grain or milk or water or whatever. He held that before him, the economists hadn't realized that it applies to wealth as such. That's not true. Galbraith just wasn't familiar enough with the history of economic thought. Bohm Bawerk and others were very much aware that it applied to wealth as such. But in any case, Galbraith thought he had the basis for some major new conclusions. Now, because wealth had lower marginal utility, its pursuit should no longer be so important. Businessmen should take a back seat. Who should be important? Well, bureaucrats and professors, both of which categories Galbraith fitted into. Now, I'd like to explain why, even though the law of diminishing marginal utility is absolutely true and important, it does not contradict the other important principle that we do have a limitless need and desire for wealth, and the pursuit of wealth, its importance does not diminish, even though the wealth we possess increases and its marginal utility diminishes. And there are a number of different reasons, and I give them in ascending order of importance. First, so long as there is any marginal utility at all to additional units of wealth, the utility of a larger supply is always greater than the utility of a smaller supply. So if you have 5 sacks of grain, having six sacks will be better than five if the sixth sack has any positive utility at all, just as five are better than four, even though feeding the parrots is not as important as the previous user. That's one point. More important, perhaps, is that the availability of more wealth as a general phenomenon is caused by a process that at the same time raises the marginal utility of additional units of wealth in comparison with what it would otherwise be. As I say, i.e., more efficient methods of production are accompanied by new types of consumers' goods, which represent new, more important uses for wealth. Now, at one time, you see, if we're asking, how did our society become richer? Well, a major part of the story goes to such things as the invention of the electric motor, the internal combustion engine, things that brought about widespread major increases in the productivity of labor. That's how we got richer. But what were these things accompanied by? Did we use the electric motor and the internal combustion engine simply to produce more of the kinds of goods that we knew about before these advances? Did we use them to sate our need for things like candles and lanterns and ox carts? See, had these new means of production been confined to producing just the old kinds of goods, larger quantities of those goods would have resulted in rapidly diminishing marginal utility. But what happened to the fall in marginal utility when, along with the electric motor, we got all of the electric appliances? And with the internal combustion engine, we got the automobile and other consumer devices. Let me try to put it this way. Suppose you are contemplating the marginal utility of the 200th horse out of 200 horses in a society where they were still using horses. Well, you might figure out, okay, I'd like half a dozen horses that'll allow me to have the fanciest coach in town, but what will I do with 200 horses? What kind of marginal utility would that 200th horse have? Well, I don't think very much, if any. You might be drowning in the manure. Who knows? But what if, when we have the advance in wealth, and we have the equivalent of 200 horses, only now it's a 200 horsepower engine in your automobile? How do you think the utility of the 200th horsepower in an engine compares with the marginal utility of the 200th horse? Or perhaps view it as the marginal utility of horsepower 101 through 200 versus the marginal utility of horses 101 through 200.
Higher.
I would say it's higher. The same process that puts us in a position to have a lower marginal utility of wealth is accompanied by new avenues of using additional wealth, and these new additional kinds of goods operate to work against the fall in the marginal utility of wealth. They provide new and additional, more valued uses for the additional wealth. But then I think there's something perhaps even more important, and that is that as the wealth at our disposal increases, the size of the marginal unit that we're dealing with will often increase also. See, the marginal unit is not something fixed and given. The marginal unit doesn't have to be one sack of grain. You could have a marginal unit that's two sacks. You could have a marginal unit that's five sacks. One of the statements my mentor Mises once made was, the marginal unit is the unit under consideration. It's the unit under consideration. And the unit under consideration could be one physical unit, or it could be a multiple. Now, for a poorer person, the marginal units under consideration, if you're quite poor, maybe they don't go much beyond a quart of milk, a can of soup, $5, those would be the marginal units. And the utility of each such unit does tend to decline. But now suppose you're at a much higher economic level, and your marginal unit is not such a meager unit, but a much larger unit. Let's say here you are, you're a multi-millionaire, and your marginal unit, you're contemplating, should you purchase a Lear jet? Earlier in your career, you were eager to obtain your first automobile. Now, do you think the marginal utility of the Lear jet is necessarily less than that of your first automobile? So you're dealing with a much larger size unit. The Lear jet is the exchange value equivalent, perhaps, of 100 automobiles or more. Why is the marginal utility of this much, much bigger unit less than the marginal utility of a much, much smaller unit? See, if we're asking, would the marginal utility of your 100th automobile be insignificant? Yes, it would. But is the marginal utility of a Lear jet equal to 100 automobiles? Is that insignificant? Is the marginal utility of a mansion, you see, there's a marginal utility of a house. There's a lesser marginal utility of a second house. Is the marginal utility of your first mansion less than the marginal utility of your first house? I don't see how that would follow. Where we allow for the increase in the size of the marginal unit, then again and again, the importance of the wealth actually under consideration, or the importance of the wealth being sought, does not diminish. Now, for someone like Bill Gates, if we ask what's the marginal utility of $1,000 or $10,000 to Bill Gates, probably zero. He wouldn't notice if he has $1,000 or $10,000 less or more. But what about the marginal utility of $1 billion? Do you think that's enough to get even Gates to sit up and take notice? I would think so. You see, with 1,000 or 10,000, well, how's that going to affect his action? He's not looking at things through a microscope. But $1 billion will be significant. And if it were not enough to be significant, then try $5 billion. It's always a question of the size of the marginal unit. And I would say that the desirable position to be in is to earn and accumulate more and more wealth, to be in the happy position that the marginal utility of a unit of wealth of any given size is diminishing towards zero. It would be very nice to be in the position where you can light your cigar with $100 or $1,000 bill and not notice the loss, while at the same time being concerned with much larger units, being concerned with the possibility of achieving your mansion or private jet or yacht or whatever it might be. And I would say the pursuit of the mansions, yachts, and jets, these units do not have a lesser marginal utility than the earlier units that people were seeking, because they're much, much bigger. So I would say the importance of the pursuit of wealth does not diminish, even though the overall quantity goes up and the marginal utility of a unit of a given fixed size diminishes. But when we allow for a bigger size marginal unit, the marginal utility does not diminish. Now, I'll just name one important application of the law of diminishing marginal utility, perhaps its most important single application, but by no means its only one. And this was the resolution of the seeming paradox of value confronting the old classical economists. The first thought of economists in explaining prices was to consider the utility of goods. The natural inclination of the early economists was the more useful something is, the more valuable it should be. But they quickly ran up against a seeming major contradiction of this. Because after all, what could be more useful than something like water? What is less necessary than something like diamonds? But which is almost always much more valuable? Diamonds are almost always much more valuable than water. And so the classical economists thought that there's a kind of paradox of value, that very often the most useful things are the least valuable, and the least useful things are the most valuable. And they thought they had to find a different explanation of exchange value and prices, another explanation besides utility. And they came to the conclusion that while it's necessary for things to be useful in some measure in order to have value, they, if they had no usefulness at all, they wouldn't be valuable, the measure of the utility is not the measure of the value. What determines the value is something different, and their conclusion was that what governs value is cost of production. Cost of production. Why are diamonds expensive and water cheap? Because typically diamonds cost vastly more to produce than water. Water is typically virtually free to acquire from nature. Diamonds have to be laboriously dug out of the ground. They have greater cost. That's why they're more valuable. Now, the principle of marginal utility makes it possible to connect value with utility. You see, what the classical economists were doing, and whoever else thinks that water is more valuable than diamonds, more useful than diamonds, they're looking at all the water versus all the diamonds. They're looking at the most important uses for water versus the most important uses for diamonds. Okay. There, water wins. But if we look at things in terms of marginal utility, suppose you have an abundant supply of water. Suppose you have ready access to water. You have all the water you can possibly drink, all the water you need to wash with, to cook your food with, clean your animals, give them water, even spray the beer cans down your driveway with your hose. So you've got plenty of water. Now, imagine that for all possible uses of water that you could possibly think of, let's say you need 1,000 gallons a day. 1,000 gallons a day of water satisfies all possible uses you can think of for water. But you have available to you 100,000 gallons of water. What's the marginal utility of gallons 1,001 through 100,000? Zero. I mean, what want satisfactions do you have to give up if instead of having 100,000 gallons, you had only 1,000 gallons? would anything be lost? Would you go thirsty? Would you be unable to wash, unable to clean things? No. So there would be zero marginal utility to gallons of water, 1,001 through 100,000. Those 99,000 gallons of water would have zero marginal utility. But what about the first carat of diamonds? Now, the first carat of diamonds is not as important as having the water to slake your thirst, maybe not as important as having the water to cook your food or many other lesser uses. But how does the value of the first carat of diamonds, which may look very, very pretty and might make a nice token of your appreciation to the love of your life, how does the marginal utility of that first carat of diamonds compare with the marginal utility of gallons 1,001 through 100,000? I'd say the marginal utility of the diamonds is higher than the water in this case. See, diamonds being more valuable than water is not a contradiction of utility if we look at utility in terms of marginal utility, not overall total utility. And there could be circumstances where the marginal utility of water again surpasses the marginal utility of diamonds. I think there was once a movie. You might find it at around 5 in the morning now. It's that old. Showing a gang of diamond thieves or some other valuable item. They steal them. They've got a bag of diamonds. And somehow they get holed up in the Sahara Desert. And they're trapped there. And in those circumstances, they become willing to trade the diamonds back for a canteen of water. So there you have the marginal utility of water surpassing that of diamonds when vital needs, in fact, come to depend on the water. But in normal, civilized circumstances, what depends on a given substantial quantity of water? What do we lack if we have that much less water? Very, very little. Less than we would lack than if we had somewhat less diamonds. So marginal utility helps to explain such a thing. And as I say, many other things. Now, what I want to jump into as we reach the last few minutes of the hour is this point A, what I refer to as the limitless potential of natural resources. A question can easily arise if we're talking about a continual rise in the productivity of labor. What about the availability of raw materials? I've made the point that we can always have more raw materials at any given time by exploiting existing deposits more intensively, by calling on submarginal deposits. But I want to go much further now and show why we can reasonably expect, at least for quite a long time, the supply of usable, accessible natural resources to increase above where it is today. Now, I have to say, please let me know if I went into this at all last week or 2 weeks ago. I'm sure you're all aware that the prevailing view on the subject of natural resources is that while we produce larger and larger supplies of products, what is our connection to the supply of natural resources? We're simply depleting them. So it's thought, yes, we can produce more automobiles, but what are we doing to the supply of iron ore and the supply related supply of oil for gasoline? It's thought we simply deplete a scarce, precious, nature-given stock of resources. You can find this theme echoed in the sign as you pass Camp Pendleton on the way driving up from San Diego. Their function, you'd think, is they're preserving California's precious resources by stopping anyone else from doing anything with that real estate. Now, I'd like to suggest a different way of looking at the supply of natural resources. The usual view is that nature gives us natural resources, and we use them up. And that's all there is to it. Nature gives us the iron mines, the oil wells, etc., And all that we're doing is using up a scarce, precious, irreplaceable stock of nature-given natural resources. I want to suggest the actuality is a little bit more complicated than that. There are, I believe, two relevant meanings of the terms of the words natural resources, which are almost always confused. There's natural resources as they come from nature, and then there is natural resources in a very different sense, in the sense of usable, economically usable, accessible natural resources. There's natural resources as they come from nature, and then there is a much narrower concept, economically usable, accessible natural resources. And these are very, very different. The latter is a subset of the former. The economically usable, accessible natural resources refers to a fraction of the natural resources provided by nature. Now let's start to consider the magnitude of natural resources provided by nature. I think nature's contribution in one respect is enormously understated, and in another respect, equivalently overstated, or enormously overstated. Suppose we could bring out the LAPD crime lab truck to do a soil sample of the lawn in front of this building. What, in principle, do you think they would find upon analyzing the soil sample? What would it consist of, in principle, without knowing the concretes?
Sometimes a fertilizer, probably.
There's fertilizer, but suppose you're doing a chemical analysis of the fertilizer. What does it break down to?
Nitrogen.
Okay, there's nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen. There might be a trace amount of aluminum. The principle is that any cubic centimeter of earth that you took anywhere, that either on the surface, the upper limits of the atmosphere, or straight down to the core, will consist of some chemical element or combination of chemical elements. Is there any part of the earth that does not consist of some chemical element or combination of chemical elements?
No.
No, the whole mass of the earth, from the upper limits of the atmosphere straight down to the core, 4,000 miles straight down, that's solidly packed chemical elements. That's nature's contribution to natural resources, plus all of the energy in the world in different forms. We have energy flowing from the sun every day. We have energy in the tides, in the molten core of the earth. We have energy in kinetic forms, locked up in the fossil fuel deposits, all different forms of energy. That's nature's contribution, too. And actually, it's broader than that. I mean, this is the minimum. This is what's limited to the Earth. We would also have to throw in the rest of the solar system, and indeed, the entire universe. Nature's actual total contribution to natural resources is all the matter and energy in the universe and all of its elemental forms, all of the different types of energy. Now, this is a virtually infinite contribution of nature, but this is not economically relevant. The economically relevant natural resources are a much, much tinier subset of that. It's the fraction of what nature has provided that has been made economically usable and accessible to man. And this relates very closely to our discussion of the nature of goods, because it implies that the supply of economically usable, accessible natural resources is not something fixed and given. It's a fraction of what nature has provided, but a fraction that is capable of expansion. The supply of economically usable, accessible natural resources is an enlargeable fraction of what nature has provided. How can we enlarge it? Well, we have to increase our understanding of the useful properties of what's out there in nature. I made the point that to our Stone Age ancestors, the metals were not usable natural resources. They were not economically usable natural resources. First, people who had to identify what uses could the metals have. Petroleum only became an economically usable natural resource, any kind of natural resource, economically accessible, recognized, sometime after 1850. I pointed out other things. Now, just consider how we actually go about increasing that fraction of the infinity that nature represents, the fraction of it that is usable by us and accessible to us, economically usable by us and accessible to us. There are two key elements. One is our understanding of nature, our scientific understanding of nature, to know what its properties are, what needs and wants that we have that they might possess. And secondly, our power of physical command over nature. And we enlarge the fraction of nature that is usable by us and accessible to us every time we increase our scientific and technological knowledge and the capacity of our capital equipment. Let's take various types of examples. Back in the early days of the petroleum industry, how deep was it possible to drill for oil? Maybe 100 feet. I mean, after all, as you go deeper, the drills can crack. You need metals that meet high performance characteristics. Today, we have oil wells that may go down 5,000 feet, maybe deeper. There are natural gas wells, I think, that go down 35,000 feet. Now, just consider, in one state of technology and capital equipment, we may only have access to wells, to oil deposits that lie within 100 feet of the surface. And then there are many deposits that may lie within 100 feet of the surface, but which may have a high sulfur content, and they were unusable for a long time. One of the important contributions of Rockefeller and the old Standard Oil Company was to develop the process of petroleum cracking, which made it possible for the first time to use petroleum deposits with a high sulfur content. They found a way to separate out the sulfur from the usable petroleum. Now, what effect did that have on the supply of usable, accessible petroleum deposits? It increased it. What is the effect every time we develop the ability to drill deeper without having to use an inordinate amount of labor? That increases it. What's the effect of satellite photography on our ability to identify petroleum deposits? That increases it. As we achieve an ability to go deeper, to go into regions we previously couldn't go into, that is enlarging the supply of usable, accessible petroleum. Now, fairly recently, the tar sands up in Alberta, Canada, I think I touched upon them earlier tonight, they had been previously altogether unusable. It's not just that oil is above $30 a barrel. There have been substantial improvements in the technology of extracting that oil to make it feasible to be profitable with the price merely being above $30 rather than being above $50 or $100. Now, geologists know that in our own Rocky Mountain states, there are deposits of petroleum in rock formations rather than a liquid form. Shale oil. Shale is oil in rock formation rather than a liquid state. But the amount of oil that's there is on the order of 10 times larger than the oil reserves of the Arabian Peninsula. What would be the effect on the supply of economically usable, accessible petroleum if and when a commercially feasible method of extracting oil from shale were to be developed? It would be multiplied beyond all previous supplies. Now, what this would require, this would take some significant breakthroughs, but it's certainly something that could happen. Beyond that, it may very well be the case someday that you'll have commercially feasible hydrogen fusion. How abundant is hydrogen if it could become a commercially viable source of fuel? It's the most abundant element in the universe. So the idea that we're stuck on a shrinking resource base, this is really not true. The reality is that over the last 200 years, even though we're taking more resources out of the ground, the supply, the proven reserves of practically every mineral have increased right along with the production. The usable, accessible supplies have grown. And you can understand this in further ways. For example, when people wanted to mine iron in 1800, how did they do it? Well, picks and shovels. Later, we got high explosives. We got the ability to sink mines deeper with steel, structural steel mine shaft supports. We developed nitroglycerin, TNT. Still more recently, we can blast the tops off of mountains and go directly at the deposits. Now, up to now, with the exception of some offshore oil wells, all of our mining activity has been confined to the land area of the world. And not all of that even. There are still inaccessible regions. When transportation is improved and more territories open up, that increases the usable, accessible supply. But notice, how deep do the deepest mines go? Presently.
A mile?
Pardon me?
A mile?
Maybe on the order of a mile. I think there's a gold mine in South Africa that goes down about a mile. And that, I would think, is about the deepest. But there are natural gas wells that go down maybe 5-7 miles, conceivably 10 miles. I'm sure there's nothing that goes deeper than 10 miles. But just think how we're literally up to now just scratching the surface, and not by any means the whole surface. As a maximum, the 30% of the surface that represents the land area. But we're on the we're already at the point where undersea mining operations are becoming feasible through robotics and fiber optics. You could start to have undersea mining operations. That's something that could develop over the rest of this century. And if it did, what would be the effect on the supply of usable, accessible minerals? Everything up to now would look like relatively small change. And if we could go down 2 miles as a maximum instead of 1 mile, what would that do? That's a tremendous advance. Now, it might be that we're locked into where we are today and we'll be faced with a dwindling supply. But that need not be. The possibilities are out there. The stuff is out there in nature. What it takes to get at it is increased scientific and technological knowledge and improved capital equipment. And what it takes to bring all this to bear is if you have a society of highly motivated people who stand to make substantial personal fortunes, if they have significant success and are free to go at it, well, what do you think the odds are if you have motivated human intelligence free to work on nature? What do you think the odds are on the fraction of nature that we can find good uses for? I would say the odds are very heavy that we'll have an increasing fraction of nature that we can put to our use. And that's what has happened over the last 2 centuries or more. But we do have the ability to stop the process. We can prohibit all possible new developments. We can take away the incentives. And then we'll be stuck with what we have and faced with the dwindling supplies and rising real costs. I made the point that rising population would cause diminishing returns. Well, even if we have a constant population, but we have no further economic progress, there'll be diminishing returns in mining because we have to dig deeper. The strains of ore become less pure. There's a certain amount of economic progress we need just to stand pat in mining. And if we stop economic progress, we would be faced with diminishing returns there. Okay, well, I think I've covered practically everything. I'll leave you with one last thought. I think there's a major implication that follows from these remarks about the Earth consisting of solidly packed natural resources, solidly packed chemical elements. If you keep that in mind, an implication is that whenever we produce things, that whenever we have economic activity, if we look at it from the point of view of physics and chemistry, all that is entailed is a movement of the same nature-given supply of chemical elements from one place to another, and from one combination, from some combinations to other combinations. Anytime we make anything, like when we make automobiles, that entails moving some part of the Earth's supply of the element iron out of places like the Mesabi Range in Minnesota and into the sides, the fenders of our cars and the sides of our refrigerators. All economic activity consists of a rearrangement of the same supply of nature-given chemical elements. But how does the same chemical element stand in relation to our life and well-being after we make these changes? Where does the element iron have a better relationship to human well-being? When it's in the ground in the Mesabi Range, or when it represents our cars and refrigerators? Where does the element iron, nitrogen, carbon, etc., where do they have a better relationship? When they're making it possible to have electric light, or when they're locked up in the bowels of the earth? I think what we're doing is systematically improving the relationship of the same chemical elements to our life and well-being. There are byproducts that work against this, but the overwhelming thrust of the positive product is an improvement in the relationship between the chemical elements and our material well-being. And if you put all that together, our environment consists of the chemical elements. The environment materially, physically, is the chemical elements, and we're improving their relationship to us through our economic activity. So economic activity is fundamentally, consistently improving our environment with some slippages in the form of byproducts. Now, this is a heretical viewpoint, shouldn't be allowed. You can call the Department of Consumer Affairs and the Dean's Office to complain. So I wish you all a good week. I'll see you Saturday morning, hopefully. 8:30 next door. Okay.
Donuts.
Yes, please. Okay. I'll take care of it Saturday.
I'll give it to you.
Okay, very good.